Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we talk with Padma Lakshmi. Now, as host of TV's reality show Top Chef, her famous line is, "Pack your knives and go." But from what I can see in her new cookbook, this woman's packed her knives to cook her way around the world. Padma's book is tangy, tart, hot, and sweet. This year, most of us are going to waste about 180 pounds of food. That's pretty stunning. Yet at least one community center is salvaging the food that we toss. They turn it into good eating, and more importantly, they feed hundreds a day. The center's cost is 32 cents a meal. We've got this story. There is a way that you can have homemade bread whenever you feel like. We talk with the authors of Artisan Bread in 5 minutes a Day. And then we play the refrigerator game, Stump the Cook. And as always, our celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball. He hosts America's Test Kitchen on PBS. And we are going to be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show, the way we do every week. Numbers 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we've been up north, and I mean really up north, to Duluth, Minnesota, where we are told in the winter the wind chill is 120 below zero. But we went in the relatively mild weather, but we still think we got the Duluth experience. And part of the Duluth experience is going to Northern Water Smokehouse.
Northern Water Smokehouse. I've missed this. Is this a restaurant, or are they doing smoked fish? Because they do a lot of smoked fish along Lake Superior.
It's both. It's a small restaurant with a few tables, but the guy who runs it, Eric Goert, G-O-E-R-D-T, calls it a micro-smokery. He makes his own bacon, pancetta. He makes this wonderful pastrami from bison meat. Now, you'd think, how could that be good? Let me tell you, it's really delicious.
But the main thing is the fish.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, yet again, I hate fish. So I'm signing off, and Michael's going to tell you all about the fish, which he said is absolutely fabulous.
Well, Lake Superior whitefish. He smokes this. And you know how whitefish, I mean, for those of us who live near the ocean, freshwater fish is a real treat, and especially for me since I come from around the Great Lakes originally. I mean, a smoked whitefish is so creamy and fresh tasting and sweet in its own, and not in a sugary way, but in that freshwater fish way.
Yeah, yeah.
It is so delicious. And he smokes these whole whitefish. You know, you buy an entire one, or for that matter, you can get a sandwich of whitefish salad or something.
And trout, too.
He smokes lake trout. He gets salmon from Alaska that he smokes. You know, the sockeye salmon, the king salmon. You can get it plain, or you can get it with a little Cajun seasoning, or you can get it with a couple of other flavors, but however you get it, it's that just unbelievably moist salmon that just flakes so easily when you just probe it with a fork.
Let me warn you about something. Michael, because he could not eat enough on the spot, and we knew we were not going to be in Duluth in the next month, got a bunch of smoked fish sent to us.
Uh-huh.
And they do mail order very well, but when we went into our little rural post office, the entire
post office smelled like fish.
And people were tearing into it, trying to get to it. I'm a little confused, though. Is it that they kind of do sandwiches that you can take out, or do they do dinners, or they do...
Well, no, not dinners. It's more of a lunch type place. I mean, if you want to eat there, they have, like, daily lunch specials.
I think there's three tables or something.
Three or four tables. On Monday, you can have a smoked bison shoulder, braised in Schlitz beer, and then topped with barbecue sauce.
Oh, that sounds great.
On Wednesday, you get the bison pastrami. On Thursday, they make a pancetta. Friday, they actually smoke pork. It's like pulled pork, and it's pretty darn good for not being in the South.
This sounds fabulous. I just have to smile at the way pancetta has, you know, become part of the lore of,
every of part Scandinavian of cuisine.
Yes, whoever heard of it?
They used to call it bacon, but now it's become pancetta.
Well, they do make bacon as well.
Sounds great. Hey.
It is great.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Tell me just what happened. Let me get this down. But I better hear the same thing. When I ask around, no one's calling you a liar, but there's no smoke without fire.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know where. SplendidTable.org. And while you're on the site, you can sign up for our two e-newsletters with new recipes every week. Weeknight Kitchen is our weekly attempt to make your midweek life a little bit easier. You get a new recipe each week along with shopping and technique tips. And then there's our seasonal e-newsletter, Baker's Chronicle. Great recipes for the weekend baking. Now, both are on the website, and best of all, both are free. SplendidTable.org. Oh, one other thing while you're on the site. Be sure to look at our latest travel opportunity. We're hatching a plan to spend some time in early summer in the Willamette Valley outside of Portland, tasting wine. Now, details are still being worked out, but there's a place to sign up for more information. And you'll find it, splendidtable.org.
Right on.
When it comes to baking your own bread, what's one man's exercise in easy serenity is another's minefield of devilish yeast, endless mixing and kneading and rising and baking. Well, this year there's a new book that has eliminated that marathon of prep and angst. It is called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. It's by physician and longtime bread baker Jeff Hertzberg and professional baker Zoe Francois. Jeff, Zoe, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Now, I should explain that Zoe and Jeff brought samples, and I mean samples. This looks like we're preparing to shoot the cover of a bread book. There's a cake of sticky bun that I can't wait to pull apart. There's a braid with fruit in it. There are some round loaves. There's a loaf that's the classic shape of a wheat sheath that they do in France. There's a pizza. There's what looks like a whole grain bread. There's a bread with caraway seed on it. It's amazing. So tell me what's different about this bread recipe.
What's fundamentally different is that you store your dough for 2 weeks at a time. We adapted, we improved on old techniques, but what we really do differently is we mix it all, store it in the refrigerator for 2 weeks so you can spontaneously bake anytime you want. And it comes out like that.
Zoe, you're the professional pastry chef. You can do this with a dough and it's not going to spoil.
Absolutely. And in fact, what we've found is quite the opposite, is that as the dough is sitting, it starts developing more complex flavors and even sourdough characteristics. It becomes better.
I'm thinking, too, one of the great keys to artisan bread making is long, slow rises because more flavors evolve.
That's right.
So you're just exaggerating that, essentially.
Exactly. You can mix it up and bake it fresh after the initial two-hour rise and have a wonderful bread, but it's going to have a very mellow taste. By the end of the first week and into the second week, you do start getting that really deep artisan flavor. It's wonderful.
So step us through the master recipe.
Okay. For the master recipe, it's four basic ingredients. We have yeast, salt, flour, and water, and that's it. And what we do is we take a bucket or a container or bowl, whatever is large enough to hold the ingredients. We take 1.5 tablespoons salt, 1.5 tablespoons yeast, put that in the bucket, dump in our 3 cups of warm water or cold, any temperature other than boiling hot.
Right.
And then dump in our 6.5 cups of flour and stir it. And that's it. We don't knead it. We just stir it until all of that flour is incorporated. And we're done. And then we let it rise for 2 hours on the counter and into the refrigerator for up to 2 weeks.
And then to make the bread, Jeff, what do? You just scoop out some of it?
You just scoop some out. You pull it up, and we use a little serrated knife. I use one from the gas station. And so you've got this little grapefruit-sized piece in your hands, and you just kind of pull the top around to the bottom, maybe 3, 4, 5 times, and turn it.
To make
a round shape. And you can then change that shape by squeezing it, then you'll have an oblong.
Uh-huh.
You could then squeeze it and drop it into a pan, then you'll have a pan bread.
Right.
But all of them, that's it for handling the dough. We don't think that handling the dough a lot is helpful. It knocks the air out of it, knocks the gas out of it. So the less you mess around with this bread, the better. We don't recommend anybody needs this stuff when they pull it out. It's just going to make it flat.
All right, so I'm looking at all of the loaves here. They're in different shapes. They're different flavorings. You've done them sweet. You've done them savory. Can I just pull out enough to make a roll?
Absolutely.
But what can I do then once I've got that basic dough?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing that we like about this technique is that it has such great variety. My mom will take out a tiny little piece of dough and make herself a single bialy in the morning. And then she can store the rest of the dough for when she wants it.
Well, the other thing that sets apart great bread, the crust. How do you get a great crust on the bread?
Well, what we do is we bake our loaves on a pizza stone. And that really conducts the heat well. And it helps to form that really wonderful crust. The other thing is that we put a broiler tray on the bottom of the oven. And when we go to put our dough in the oven, we throw a hot cup of water into the broiler tray. It creates a steam environment, and it's the perfect condition for that kind of crisp, crackly, authentic crust.
Well, I want to take a taste.
Right.
And I'm looking at one here. It's in France, it's called the AP, and it means a sheaf of wheat. And it's this, to me, has always been sort of one of the great classic breads. So this is the basic recipe. Nothing is in it.
No, that's it.
It's just from the master. It's one of the 6 shapes we do.
The crackle is fabulous. All right. The aroma is wonderful. How long was this in the fridge? It smells so wheaty.
That one is just about a week old.
It is.
Yeah.
Boy, it has great aroma. Crust is wonderful, and there's a slightly sour tang, but it's not annoying.
Yeah.
Oh, that's dynamite.
Yeah, thanks.
And you talk about this custardy, moist, but tug-at-the-tooth crumb.
Right.
The inside of the bread.
And that, theoretically, is what everybody said you have to knead in order to get. And she never needed that loaf when
this
she made
it. This is fabulous. This is great. Hey, Zoe, Jeff, thanks so much. Excuse me. My mouth is full. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, man.
And where's the butter?
Oh, it's right. It's by the knife.
Zoe Francois and Jeff Hertzberg are authors of Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. Now, you can find their master bread recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Top Chef's Padma Lakshmi in the kitchen and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Please pack up your knives and go. Well, that's the famous line that you hear at the end of each episode of TV's Top Chef. The woman who utters it is the show's host, Padma Lakshmi. Model, actress, named by People magazine as one of the 100 most beautiful people of 2007, but believe it or not, Padma comes by her position on Top Chef rightly. She cooks, seriously, and has been doing it much of her life. Padma's book is Tangy, Tart, Hot, and Sweet, A World of Recipes for Every Day. Padma, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your food. When did you actually start to cook? Were you a child?
Oh, yes. I started cooking very early on. You know, all the action of the house was in the kitchen, and it was there that we traded secrets of the family. The decisions were made. All the gossip was exchanged. So very early on, I began to equate sort of, you know, cooking with femininity.
Where did you actually grow up?
I grew up shuttling between Manhattan and what was then called Madras and is now called Chennai, India.
So it's
in the south of India.
South of India.
Yes.
Now, your mother moved from India to New York?
My mother moved to the States, to New York. She divorced my father, and at that time it was very difficult for a divorcee in India. And she started to work at Sloan Kettering Hospital. She's a nurse. And I followed her shortly after, a couple of years, actually, not very shortly, after she got settled. And I think, you know, New York City and growing up in New York City really has formed my culinary identity. We would go to Chinatown and we would go to Spanish Harlem and you know, hunt and gather all these different things that would wind up in pots in our kitchen. And I think that's really served me well today.
Yeah, it's interesting because this book covers the world and the recipes feel so firsthand. I mean, they don't feel like you've read about them. They feel like you've eaten them. So how did
we have. No, I think what, you know, I wanted to do a book for really the way that we eat now. I almost called it that, the way we eat now. And it's because if you think about what most of us have eaten in the last week or 10 days, it's probably all over the map. It's probably, you know, Thai, Indian, Mexican, yeah. Italian, Japanese, Moroccan, you know, whatever. And so I wanted to do that at home. I wanted to teach people how to take classic recipes like crab cakes or chicken soup or macaroni and cheese and sort of just gussy them up a bit, you know, with some interesting ingredients. Like if you really look at the recipes, it doesn't require that much technical skill to be able to make the recipes. What it requires is just a very nicely stocked pantry. And it's that pantry is to a chef what a painter's box is to an artist.
So in your pantry now, if I say to you, pick four things that would be absolutely essential, what would they be?
Well, four is really hard for me, but I would say
I would say it was going to be easy.
I would say coconut milk, which I personally use a lot. I think it's much more refreshing than say cream or, you know, any of other mm-hmm. thickening agents. Mm-hmm. And I use the low fat for every day, by the way. I also love ginger. I really like sumac powder because it's a souring agent that doesn't have moisture. Sumac comes from a berry that grows in America, actually. They used to use it in cough syrup. They use it a lot in Middle Eastern cooking. It has this beautiful vermilion color. It looks great as a garnish, but it also adds tartness. And, you know, the fourth ingredient is kaffir lime leaves because I love the aroma of kaffir lime leaves in stews, in soups. And I stuff it into the cavity of roasts, roasted chicken and duck as well.
And those are showing up in supermarkets now as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a dish in the book that has a name you've got to explain to me. Two hens laughing.
Well, you know, it is because we used to sit around the family table and we used to make up names for things, you know, like names that never were, like A Farewell to Weapons or, you know, Mr. Zhivago, names that didn't work out.
Yeah, and so
we started doing it with whatever I was serving at the table. And there were just two Cornish game hens that were facing each other. And their legs were kind of splayed because I didn't tie them. And so, you know, somebody looked at the platter and said, hey, look, it's two hens laughing. Or like there's a salad called A Very Herbaceous Salad. So it's putting a little wit into the food, I guess.
Talk to me about your mother. You talk about her. You said at one point she is a Brahmin culinary heretic.
Yes. I mean, you know, my mother came to this country in the 70s, and it wasn't that cool to be Indian then. You know, India has had two cool moments. Once when the Beatles went to India, and then once when, you know, Madonna started taking up yoga, and then, you know, sort of Deepak Chopra carried that wave, and we have Ayurveda and Tantra and stuff. But, you know, when I first came to this country, I was a vegetarian. My mother wanted me to assimilate to our new home and in the country. And kids can be very cruel when you go to have lunch at the school lunch table. And I used to bring these little plastic containers of curry and rice, and they'd all be eating these neat little sandwiches with a crust cut off. And she wanted me to eat meat. For a long time, we could only go to Chinese restaurants because I would eat white rice with Tabasco and soy sauce because that was the closest thing to what I was eating. So she forced me to eat meat. And then, of course, she recanted. And she wanted me to go back to being vegetarian. She thought that was really healthy. But it was too late. By then, I had started this flaming love affair with bacon.
And she introduced you to bacon?
She introduced me to Bacos, imitation bacon, and on my salads as a way to actually usher me into eating meat.
A very, very interesting mom.
Very interesting. This book is really a love song to my mother.
That's lovely. Hey, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Padma Lakshmi is author of Tangy Tart, Hot and Sweet, A World of Recipes for Every Day. Now, you can find Padma's recipe for two hens laughing on the website splendidtable.org. Did you know that one quarter of our food ends up in landfills? To borrow the latest PC phrase, this is not sustainable. Well, one community center is turning that statistic on its ear. Duluth's Damiano Center feeds hundreds of people a day on the foods that stores and farmers and restaurants have to throw away. Maybe this is a study in ending modern American waste. Well, the Splendid Table's Jennifer Russell and Jennifer Lubke went to Duluth to find out.
The Damiano Center is in an old brick schoolhouse in the Central Hillside neighborhood of Duluth, Minnesota. Executive Director Eric Torch says Damiano's soup kitchen has come to rely heavily on salvaged food. We joined him in the soup kitchen for lunch. Beef barley soup and green salad were on the menu.
In a given year, we'll salvage about 130,000 pounds of food. I mean, that food would be going to the landfill. It would be going to waste. And, you know, this is a great way to reduce the amount of waste that we have in our community, and at the same time, making sure that people who aren't able to provide enough food for themselves are able to avoid hunger.
Damiano's soup kitchen serves 12 meals a week out of a basement cafeteria. Breakfast and lunch are served at no cost to anyone who shows up looking for a meal.
We'll serve between 85,000 and 90,000 meals over the course of a year. And certainly, you know, at the beginning of the month, we could maybe serve about 150 to 200 people per meal. At the end of the month, it could often be, you know, as much as 300 and sometimes even 400 people. You know, so nobody has to give their name. There's no eligibility. They don't have to prove that they're hungry or that they lack the means to pay for a meal. They just can walk right in and get served.
Damiano serves those meals with an annual food budget of roughly $28,000. That boils down to a small handful of change per meal.
You know, we have about 32 cents to spend on a tray of food, you know, for the entire year. It's a lot of food and not a lot of money, and so using donated and salvaged food is really critical to making that happen.
Torch says that a lot of people who use their services are working people on the edge financially. They struggle to pay their rent and their bills, and often food is the first thing that gets cut from their budgets.
So, I mean, this is a typical lunch that we serve. I mean, it's not always soup that we serve in the soup kitchen. We work, you know, very hard to make sure that the meals are kind of fresh and well-balanced.
Planning ahead isn't easy when you rely heavily on donated food to feed a big crowd.
Our food availability ebbs and flows, and the staff do a tremendous job at figuring out sort of what's available and coming up with a pretty tasty and nutritious meal, depending on what's in the refrigerator and what's in the freezer that day, or what comes off the truck. Although sometimes the experiments kind of crash and burn terribly. I remember one day where we had carp chili, and that was, you know, that was probably at all times. You could hear a pin drop in the dining room. Just nobody was coming for that.
We're gone pretty quickly.
Head cook Loretta Connor works in a small kitchen with a handful of volunteers. She is the queen of improvisation.
You do a lot of guessing and hope you come out right. I'm pretty good at it. I have stuff available for backup if I run out. So I just try to make it all work.
Most meals served in Damiano's soup kitchen are made from scratch using fresh ingredients that have been donated from restaurants, grocery stores, and other commercial entities in the area.
One of the big misconceptions is that, you know, because we're using salvaged food, that we're just getting, you know, kind of like slop, you know, just nothing that's very good. But that actually couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, some of the stuff that we get is awesome. For instance, you know, we're often making, you know, beef stew or something with porterhouse steaks or T-bones. You know, these really expensive cuts of meat, which, you know, they don't sell an awful lot of them. And so when they get to the sell-by date, then we get them.
But donations like that are an exception and not the rule. When Damiano opened their doors, it was supposed to be on a temporary basis. That was 25 years ago. In the early days, it was a hard sell to get restaurants and grocers to agree to salvage their food. Volunteers used their own vehicles to transport the goods. There was a fair amount of dumpster diving going on, as well as pressure to beat out the local pig farmers.
And sometimes the food was in good shape, but oftentimes it was, it was horrible. You know, it might have been, if you're lucky, you sort of get that right after they throw it away. But if not, it could just be, sweltering or, frozen to the dumpster. And it was definitely not a pretty sight.
In addition to a small staff and an army of volunteers, Damiano now counts on refrigerated recovery trucks that are driven by certified safe food handlers to deliver salvaged food directly to the center. On this day, cook Loretta Connor is excited by what the truck has to offer.
How much of your meat can I have?
As much as you want.
Okay. Sandy told me to take lots of meat, and that doesn't happen often, so... This was a good day.
In 1996, President Clinton passed the Good Samaritan Food Donation Act into law. That legislation provides uniform national protection to citizens, businesses, and nonprofit groups that act in good faith to donate, recover, and distribute excess food that might otherwise go to waste. While some businesses are still reluctant to donate unused or out-of-date food and worry about liability issues, most have embraced the movement.
And thankfully, we eventually convinced a lot of the retail grocers and restaurants that, you don't have any liability and that this is a great way to use food that you can no longer use. So it reduces your trash bill and helps, people who are hungry.
Our very own producer, Jennifer Russell, and technical director, Jennifer Lubke, produced this piece. It's time to play Stump the Cook, our refrigerator game, with our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball. Now, Christopher is the editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine, and he's host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, good to have you back.
Oh, I can't wait to see if you're going to win or lose. I'm hoping on the latter, but you might win.
All right, okay. Why don't you explain the rules?
Sure. There'll be five ingredients that our guest has in his or her refrigerator. You get water, salt and pepper, and some sort of fat like oil or butter for
mm-hmm.
free.
Right.
And then you can request up to three extra ingredients that they also have in their house. And you have to come up with a single recipe that our guest would actually want to make.
Okay.
All and right. Me too, by the way.
Yeah, because you have the final say. I want to change
that,
those
you?
Rules, but we'll discuss that later. So, who's playing?
Today we have Mark. Are you there, Mark?
Yes, I am.
And where are you calling from?
Los Angeles, California.
Okay, so what are your five ingredients that you have in your refrigerator?
Well, we start with heirloom tomatoes.
Heirloom tomatoes. Oh, I want you to get them out of the fridge. But go ahead. Okay.
Italian frying peppers.
All right, frying Ooh. Peppers, right.
Thai rice noodles.
Thai rice noodles, okay.
Fresh shiitake mushrooms.
Shiitake.
And lamb's tongues.
I beg your pardon?
Lamb's tongues.
Lamb's tongues. Are they cooked or uncooked?
Uncooked.
Okay.
Things were going well for you, Lynn.
I know. I was on a real roll, but I have
you
to tell you.
You were on a roll.
People turn up their noses at tongue, and tongue can be fabulous. I have got a dish that you are going to go nuts over. All right. Now,
uh-oh.
I can use water, salt, pepper, and some kind of oil, and then three things that you have to have in your house. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, Mark. What we're going to do is you're going to take those lamb's tongues and you're going to go to the underneath part of the tongue, and there's kind of a cartilage under there at the base of the tongue. You're going to trim that away, and you're going to take a large pot of simmering water that has a little salt in it, and you're going to very gently cook those tongues until they're tender.
Okay.
All right.
How many tongues do we have?
Yeah, how many do we have?
Four.
Four. Okay.
This will be for two people.
Okay. Now, do you have vinegar or lime juice?
I do have vinegar.
Okay.
Wait, I have lime juice because I have some frozen.
Oh, that's great. All right. So when those tongues are really, really tender, you're going to take them out of the liquid, and now they're going to be as tender as butter. And you're going to just peel them a little bit. I know people get upset about this, but there is sort of a skin on the tongue. And you are going to slice them absolutely paper thin.
Can I ask you a question, Lynn?
Yeah.
When did you cook lamb's tongue?
I cooked lamb's tongue when I studied charcuterie in Paris.
Ah, I knew. I was a setup. I knew you were going to say
we
that.
We made a classic French dish.
Okay.
It's like a head cheese. It's called Lure. And that's L apostrophe U-R-E.
I'm sorry I asked that question.
All
but
right.
Okay.
So here's the deal. The idea is you're going to pickle this. This is what the Germans do all the time. You're going to pickle the tongue lightly in a marinade of sugar. Okay, the lime juice, and then we want some fresh ginger. All right, okay. So there I've used up my three ingredients. But you're going to combine that. You're going to let it sit for a couple of hours. And then all you have to do then is thin slice the shiitake. You can lightly cook them if you'd like. You know, just give them a very light stir fry. Are those rice noodles fresh or are they dry?
Those are dry.
They're dry. You're going to soak them in hot water until they're tender, which is maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and drain them. You're going to thin slice the Italian frying peppers, okay? And you could saute those with the shiitake. And then what you're going to do is you're going to slice the heirloom tomatoes and sort of put the round slices around the edges of a large plate.
Lynn, wait a minute. Mark, do you have, you glossed by this, the ginger and the sugar?
Oh,
do you have that?
Sorry.
I have all of those.
Okay.
Ah, I knew he did.
I knew he did.
Okay.
So here's the idea. You're going to essentially make a rice noodle salad. You're going to take those slices of tongue with their dressing, and you're going to toss them with the rice noodles and with those frying peppers and the shiitake. Okay, you season it with salt and pepper to taste. And then what happens is that you're going to pile that mixture in the center of this sort of ring of red tomato slices. And you can decorate it with some raw frying peppers, and it'll be absolutely fabulous.
And what country, Lynn, would this be coming from?
Well,
multicultural recipe?
I am thinking the Southeast Asia general area.
That's what I was thinking,
area.
Too, yes.
And the lambs wandered in from Mongolia.
they came off the boat.
Yeah, I never told you this, Chris, but there are famous shepherds that herd their flocks from Mongolia down to Thailand every season.
It takes years.
California fusion and be done.
Yeah. Mark, thank you.
So, Mark, what do you think?
I think it works.
Yeah, I think it works, too. I think that was really a little charcuterie thing was a winner. Nice job.
Thank you, Mark. You were a man of great discernment and great taste.
My pleasure.
And Chris?
Lynn, you did it again.
I won.
That lamb's tongue would have stumped me. But once again, you were a winner.
I feel like a queen. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Christopher Kimball's day job is editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, give us a call at 800-537-5252 and leave us a message. One of our sneaky producers may call you to invite you to play. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what bean is given to those suspected of witchcraft? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what bean is given to those suspected of witchcraft? Well, the answer is the Calabar bean. It comes from West Africa. Now, in his book, Beans, A History, history professor Ken Albala tells the Calabar story. It is never used as food, but it is used in West Africa, and this is a quote, as an ordeal bean. Calabar is given to people suspected of witchcraft. Eat and live, and you're exonerated. And the other way Calabar is used is in a version of Russian roulette, but without the gun. People take turns eating the bean to see who survives. Ken's got a whole chapter on beans that he calls oddballs and villains. And there are some interesting names named, as in you might run into one or two in recipes. The book is called Beans, A History. And aside from this chapter, there's a lot of great positive bean lore and information. It's a good read. It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Give us a call. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Ruth calling from Portland, Oregon. Ruth, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm going to have a solstice dinner, and I'm trying to plan my menu. I have a rather large pork loin, which was one of the things I was thinking about, but I'm really open for other things. What I want is something that is sort of splendid looking, but isn't real difficult to do. I kind of enjoy the idea of parading around the the pudding at the end and parading around the meat and clapping and singing and that sort of thing.
Right, right.
So what kinds of ideas do you have for a solstice dinner?
Oh, well, when you say pork roast, the first thing that comes to mind is, I haven't done this in years. It may end up on my table too. There's a way that you can take a solid piece of meat and turn it into something so incredibly festive, and it's a cut that you do. So picture, is the meat on the bone or off the bone?
It's on the bone.
Take it off the bone.
Okay.
Which is very simple to do. You know, just run, the way you bone anything, you probably know this, is if you keep one side of the knife blade flat against the bone and just keep cutting and keep pushing the meat away so you can see where the blade's going, you're boning. So don't throw out the rack. Don't throw out the bones. You're going to use them in the pan. But what you want is a solid piece of meat, okay? And what you're going to do then is take a long, sharp knife, all right? And you're going to make essentially a cut. If you can picture this, picture a cylinder. You're going to make a cut about an inch in from the surface, all right? So that you're going to cut all the way the length of that cylinder, and you're going to cut doing a spiral to its center so that when you're done cutting, you can open up this round piece of meat into a flat piece of meat.
A long flat piece.
Yes. And now what you do is you stuff that. And I like to use things that don't need to be cooked. So they're already cooked. So, for instance, you could put saffron rice in there that has pistachios and dark raisins and sautéed greens. You could have candied fruit in that mix. You could go something very spicy. You could go in the direction of using combinations that speak of Mexico. Cumin, coriander, fresh coriander, chilies. You see, but you see what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
You roll it up again, and you tie it with strings at intervals at about an inch and a half or so. And then to make it, to cook it, okay, what you want to do is put those bones in the roasting pan as a rack, all right? Yeah. Throw in some chopped onion, carrot, and celery, which will only give your pan juices fabulous flavor. If you want to, throw in some of the flavorings from the stuffing, you see, so you'll carry out that flavor. Put the pork on that and then slow roast it at about 325. And if it doesn't get nice and brown on the outside, flip on the broiler. Watch it, though. This is a woman who cremated a chicken two nights ago by stepping away from the broiler.
And I did a pan yesterday like that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really amazing what happens in an extra minute. But at any rate, that kind of thing also, if you do it a really slow roast, you can also let it sit for about 15 minutes before you roast it. You get a little grace time. It's spectacular looking. You know, you can arrange it on a platter, put small clusters of grapes around it, do, you know, green leaves of some kind, and just make it look like, you know, to bespeak of the richness of this time of year and yet the fertility that's coming when, you know, when the sun is at the other end of the spectrum, when, you know, with the solstice in June.
What a beautiful way of saying it. This is wonderful.
And again, you can do that with any solid piece of meat. Pork, I adore doing it with because I love pork.
Yeah, and pork's so juicy, and so it really
And it takes so many different kinds of seasonings. So have a wonderful solstice party.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. That idea, by the way, is something you can apply to just about anything. And if you think that you're trying to open it up, you're trying to cut this spiral so that you're opening it up like unrolling a piece of paper that's been rolled into a tube, that'll help you imagine it. We have got Pat calling from Durham, North Carolina. Pat, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about pumpkin. About this time every year, I think back to an experience that I had when I was living in Germany, and a German friend of ours made pickled pumpkin.
Huh.
I'd never had it before. It was delicious. And I thought, how odd that I've had such a hard time over the years trying to find a recipe for how to do it, because after all, I come from the land of, you know, pumpkins are us, and I figured that I would be able to find it. So, but I haven't, and I have thought that perhaps you might be able to help me out with how to do it.
Now, describe exactly what it was like. Was it like a pickle in the sense that it was in a, you know, a sweet tart brine, you know, or sort of a syrup?
Like a sugary, vinegary type of I don't know what you call it.
Well, marinade, for lack of a better word. And how was the pumpkin cut?
It was cut, if I remember, this is going a ways back, but I think that they were cut in small sticks or cubes.
And were they very crunchy, or had it already been cooked?
They were, it had obviously had been cooked, and this was one of the reasons that I haven't just tried to wing it on my own to do this, but they did have a bit of a crisp to it, almost like a regular pickle would,
I'm just wondering, because there's two ways you could do this. I've never actually done this, but I've eaten, not German pickled pumpkin, but in the Mediterranean, I've had pickled pumpkin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to give you two alternatives, and I would suggest you do a small batch of each and see which works better.
Sure. Okay.
One would be to take, you want to start out with some really sweet sugar pumpkin. Don't use the jack-o'-lantern pumpkin. It's deader than a doornail.
Right.
So you want some sugar pumpkin. And by the way, it could be other squash. I mean, it could be kombucha. It could be butternut, because they're all going to work. And I would cut it into those sticks on the thin side. Okay? Mm-hmm. I'm stressing on the thin side. And what I would do is you'd take about 4 cups of that, okay?
Uh-huh.
I would add some sliced onion, like a cup of sliced onion. I don't know if it was in there or not, but it never hurts to do sliced onion.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going by a basic icebox pickle recipe that I love, except we're going to substitute pumpkin.
Uh-huh.
And what you're going to do is you're going to put all of that in a big bowl, either glass or stainless steel, and you're going to add an equal amount of ice cubes. So like if it's 5 cups, you're going to have about 5 cups of ice cubes and 2.5 tablespoons of coarse salt, like kosher salt. And you're going to toss that all together.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to let that sit for 4 or 5 hours.
Wow.
And what's going to happen is that some of that salt's going to permeate that pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
Then what you're going to do is you're going to drain it, all right? And you're going to throw away any ice cubes that are still in their entirety, okay?
Right.
And don't rinse it. Just drain off and get rid of the ice cubes, all right?
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, you're going to take about 2 cups of vinegar and 2 cups of sugar.
Okay.
All right? About 10 cloves, whole cloves, 2 tablespoons of black peppercorns that you've lightly bruised, maybe some turmeric, maybe 20 whole allspice that you've crushed.
Uh-huh.
All right? 2 teaspoons of mustard seed, something in that neighborhood, some coriander seed, about the same amount. Put that all in a saucepan, bring it to a simmer, cover it, and let it simmer for about 4 minutes.
Okay.
You could do that while the pumpkin's sitting.
Right.
And then what you do is drop the pumpkin into that mixture. Bring it up to a boil, all right,
mm-hmm.
and let it cook for about 2 or 3 minutes. And then put it in clean jars. Make sure everything is covered by that syrup. Let it cool down and stick it in the fridge. It's going to keep for, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. Wonderful. In the refrigerator. It's not something you put on the shelf. It's in the refrigerator.
Right.
Now, the alternative is use the exact same idea of that syrup, you know, equal parts sugar and vinegar, generous amount of spices, okay, mm-hmm. that you melt by simmering them. But cut the pumpkin in sticks and first boil it with some heavily salted water just until it's tender crisp. Drain it, rinse it with cold water, then sprinkle it with a little bit of salt, and then throw that into the syrup and continue as I said before.
Okay.
So
well,
one way or the other.
But salt isn't something I would have thought to do, so that's
it
a very interesting tip.
It helps draw out some of the moisture. You see? And it's partially a preserving process as well.
Right. Okay.
See what happens. I think either way.
I'm very excited. Thank you.
Yeah. And the syrup is the key. Taste the syrup. Don't burn yourself. Let it cool a little bit to see if it resembles the flavor you remember, because the syrup is what made the pumpkin taste.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Excellent.
Hey,
thank you so much.
You
I appreciate it.
You take care.
Have a good holiday.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us, 800-537-5252. I was watching CBS Sunday Morning a while ago, and they were doing a piece on why we love lists. Well, one guest was co-author of the new book of lists. He's David Walachinsky, and when he was asked if there was a list he felt wasn't complete, he said he would like to know more about great sausage events. Well, I couldn't let this one get by me. David Walachinsky is on the phone. David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, you said more great sausage events. So can you define what a great sausage event is?
Well, it's any, you know, historical event or crime in which sausages were involved.
So how many did you have before this announcement on CBS Sunday Morning?
I had a list of 8 great sausage events going back to ancient times and pretty much up until the 21st century.
Can you give me a few examples?
Well, sure. You know, and what we call, I give a name to them, comic sausage, heathen sausage, fatal sausage, insolent sausage, human sausage. So, for example, I had, in the 19th century, there was a great sausage murder in which Adolf Lutgert, who was a sausage maker in Chicago, had great problems with his wife, and he was accused of killing his wife. Her body was never found, but human teeth and bones and a couple rings were found at the bottom of one of his sausage vats.
Now, what about heathen sausage?
Well, heathen sausage, you know, Constantine the Great, he outlawed the production and consumption of sausage, which he considered to be sinful and pagan. So that the Romans finally had a black market on sausage. You know,
this is an ancient Rome, right?
Yes, this is an ancient Rome. You know, Constantine the Great, you know, he was emperor in the 4th century.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, sausage was banned for quite a while until the ban was finally lifted several Christian emperors later.
And I noticed, I'm looking at the book, Speeding Sausage.
Yes, I was very happy to have found this one. This was in Finland. Traffic fines are calculated according to the income of the offender.
What an interesting system.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I would be curious to see if that happened, certainly here in my neighborhood. They get a lot of money. But so the record at the time of the book in 2004, the largest traffic fine ever was $216,900, and that's because the speeder, his name was Jussi Salonoka, and he was the owner of a huge sausage business, and his annual income was almost $9 million a year. So based on a percentage of his income, he had to pay a speeding ticket of $216,000.
And he didn't pay it in sausage.
No.
Well, now you announced on CBS Sunday Morning that you were looking for more great sausage events. So have any gems come in?
Well, I did come across one, although it wasn't actually a result of the show, which was the murder trial of the Sausage King of San Leandro, California. And this was Stuart Alexander. He called himself the Sausage King. He had a sausage a factory.
Uh-huh.
And he murdered 3 meat inspectors in 2000 It was very difficult for him to defend himself at the trial because the murders were caught on his own surveillance video, and he was convicted in October of 2004, and he actually died in prison.
It must be so much fun to dig this stuff up.
Well, yes. I mean, we've always tried to specialize in the lists that you can't just look up on the internet. The ones you really have to collect over the years, one item at a time. We do have mammoth cheeses, unusual recipes, that sort of thing.
David, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Walachinsky is co-author of the new book of lists. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Benjamin Franklin. He said, and I quote, "Fools make feasts, wise men eat them." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, for information on nearly everything you heard today, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle, our newsletter devoted to baking. Sign up, splendidtable.org. And just in case you miss us one week, you'll find free podcasts of our entire program at that very same website, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.